everyone. Before we start, I wanted to let you know, if you would like to watch our whole service, head to our website. That's dc2.me. And from the media drop-down, click sermons. You can watch our whole service there. And now, here's this week's sermon.
Hi, everybody. Can you hear me? All right. I'm so glad to be with you this morning. I want to start with my 9-year-old son. He loves tricky and secret things, like escape rooms and puzzle boxes and pranks and secret bases. And a while back, we threw him a detective party. And we discovered this method of sending secret messages. So you can download this from the internet. Well, maybe not that. It's coming. There you go. When you look at this, the naked eye might not see very much, but if you look at it through a blue lens, this is what pops out. No, that's when you don't see very much. If you look at it through a blue lens, this is what pops out. But if you were to look at it from a red lens, you would see a totally different message. Now, what's so fascinating about this kind of thing is that there can be two people technically looking at the same thing, but the takeaways and messages that those two people bring are totally different. In this series, we've been talking about how different time periods and different cultures can read the Bible or come to Christian community and take away very different things based on their cultural perspective. But let's face it, not all of our lenses are external, like culture. Some of them are internal, from our traumas, from our histories, from our genetics. And sometimes those lenses can really shape what our takeaway is from scripture or from community. Let's take two women, for example, that I've had the chance to read the Bible with. The first one, her name is Helen. And she volunteers for Christian ministry probably 16 hours a week. She leads worship, she leads Bible study, she's a camp counselor, she's doing justice initiatives. She got the whole thing going on, right? And she has super high moral standards for herself. And when I have read the Bible with her, it's almost like she sees it as a checklist. Like, I know that, I'm doing that, I'm working on that. Maybe I could work a little on it, but you know, I'm doing better than other people. Now, let's take another woman. Her name's Cindy. Now, what's fascinating about Helen and Cindy, they come from the same culture, they come from the same town, they've gone to the same schools, even the same church. They're just a few years apart. But Cindy has been through some things that Helen hasn't been through. And when Cindy reads the Bible with me, she is desperately looking for evidence that God could still love her, despite some of the things that have been done to her and despite some of the ways that she has responded. But when Cindy finds evidence that God is the kind of God that gives her second chances, it is really hard for her to believe and feel that she has been forgiven. She's the kind of person who goes to the biggest churches possible. And she comes in after the sermon has started, and she leaves before anybody will talk to her because she's so afraid that if somebody interacts with her, they'll find out that she's not great. Two women, same context, same culture, totally different approach. Now, this doesn't just happen in our time. This also has happened in Jesus' time. When we read about him healing somebody, you see some people who are like celebrating and dancing in the aisles, and other people feel threatened or skeptical. But nobody knew this better than Jesus. One of the weird things is if you go through the Gospels and you watch how Jesus responds to people who are oppressed, insecure, hurting, guilt-ridden, filled with shame. He has one kind of response for that kind of people. And then if you go through and you look how he responds to people who seem like they have it together, people who are educated or rich or feel like they're on top of the world, he has kind of a different response to those people. same culture, but Jesus tailors his response to the person. When we read the Bible, it's actually not enough just to read it. We also need to become aware of the lens that we are bringing to our reading. And then, if we can see how does Jesus respond to people who are like us, who have our lens, that helps us to know what the Bible is probably saying to people like us. So I want us to look at two guys from the same culture back in Jesus' day that approached God through a very different lens and see what kind of response did Jesus give to each of those guys. Jesus told this parable to some who trusted in themselves that they were righteous and treated others with contempt. Two men went up to the temple to pray. One was a Pharisee and the other a tax collector. The Pharisee, standing by himself, prayed like this: God, I thank you that I'm not like other men, extortioners, unjust, adulterers, or even like this tax collector here. I fast twice a week. I give tithes of all that I get. But the tax collector, standing far off, he wouldn't even lift his eyes up to heaven, but he beat his breast, saying, God, be merciful to me, a sinner. I tell you, this man went down to his house justified rather than the other. For everyone who exalts himself will be humbled, but the one who humbles himself will be exalted. Now, before we dive in, I want us to first notice what our takeaways might be from our culture, 21st century, suburban, America, maybe with some terms that come out of the evangelical tradition. This is how we might read it, just kind of where we're coming from. A pastor, and the red terms are kind of us, a pastor and an IRS auditor both went to church for a quiet time. The pastor prayed, hey, thanks God that I'm better than people who take advantage of others. I do lots of spiritual practices, and I give more than the recommended amount to Christian ministry. But the IRS guy, he felt really, really bad and prayed, God, please forgive me for my sins. The IRS guy got forgiven. The pastor didn't. So God will make sure that arrogant people get shamed, but God will make things go well for humble people. All right. Now, some of those takeaways are legit. Even 2,000 years after Luke was written, we still hear loud and clear the message that God values humility over arrogance, and that our posture before God is more important than our titles and our resumes. That's legit. But if in addition to our own lens, we also look back through the lens of Middle Eastern culture, some other cool things pop out, some other good takeaways. So let's check that out. So Kenneth Bailey was a scholar who lived and taught in various Middle Eastern cultures for over 60 years. And he was living with Middle Eastern Christians who spoke Semitic languages that were pretty close to original Aramaic and Hebrew. And some of the customs that they live out even to this day are very similar to the ones that people in Jesus' time lived out. So what Kenneth Bailey would do is he would say, how would these Middle Eastern Christians look at these stories? What would they see that we don't see? So one of the things that he saw was that when in Semitic languages, when somebody says they're going up to the temple to pray, especially when it's more than one person at a time, that means they're going to an atonement service. And these services happened about twice a day, and they would involve a priest killing a lamb for the sins of the people, and then there were cymbals, there was incense, they would read some psalms, and then the priest would go back into the inner part of the temple, and so then the people who attended the service would be left there, and they would have a chance to respond to the service with their individual prayers. That's probably what these guys were doing. Now, before we move on, atonement is kind of a churchy word. What does that mean? I want you to think about the last time you got sideways with somebody. There's tension, you're not close, maybe it's a friend, maybe it's a spouse. And then when you decide, we want to get back close together, we want to reconcile, you might, you know, say you're sorry, you might make amends for whatever the heck happened, and then what might you do? Well, sometimes we kind of, we hug it out, right? We open our arms in an embrace to say, we're back at one, we're back together. At one was the word John Wycliffe invented for atone, right? So what God has initiated in an atonement service is a way every day for his people to come back and feel at one with him. It's the way to get back into God's embrace if you feel like you got sideways with God. It's pretty cool. All right, so how do these guys respond to the I just got back in the embrace of God's service? Okay, so the Pharisee, how is he praying? Well, he is standing by himself and he's praying, God, thanks that I'm not like other men, extortioners, unjust, adulterers, like the tax collector. I fast twice a week and I give tithes. Now, in first century Judaism, prayer often involved three elements. One was thanking God for what he had done. Another was confession of sins. And then the third was making requests for help. How's this guy doing? Well, we don't got a lot of requests for help here, right? There's not a confession, certainly. And who's he thanking? Well, he's thanking God he's better than everybody else, right? Zero for three. Now, what's interesting is it doesn't say he is praying by himself. It says he's standing by himself. And Bailey notes that the Greek term there means he's just pulled back a tiny bit from the crowd, just enough so he doesn't touch anybody who's unclean. But he's still in earshot. And the Jewish custom, unlike ours, was to pray aloud. So as he's saying, hey, God, thanks that I'm better than everybody else, it's in earshot of all of his friends. Yuck, right? And one of the things that we pick out from Middle Eastern culture is that our posture with God directly affects our posture with our neighbor. We're used to quiet times that are kind of on our own, just me and Jesus, right? But for them, so many more of their spiritual practices happen right in community. So it's so clear, loving God, loving others, not separate things. Now, the fact that he's praying this in community actually gives us some hope for this guy, right? Because in community, maybe there's a lovely, wise mentor who could kind of pull him aside and go, hey, dude, you're a little off from the heart of God. If he were praying this alone, tooting his own horn, how long would it take him to realize that he had gotten off? Now, don't get me wrong. I am an introvert. I love just me and Jesus' spiritual practices. I really do. And they are not enough for helping us become who God called us to be. In community, we can hear different insights from God that we never would have thought about on our own. We can feel God's love through other people, and we can get disappointed. And it's messy. And it turns out that the mess of community is actually one of God's favorite ways to get us back on track to becoming like him. We've got to have both. So this Pharisee at his stage of his spiritual journey, he is approaching God from the lens of earning by comparison. Earning-based entitlement. He believes, he's not asking for atonement. He's not asking that God would mercifully embrace him. He thinks he's owed it because of what he's done. I want you to hold on to the lens of earning. Now let's pop over to the tax collector. The concept of IRS auditor that I used a minute ago, that doesn't quite get at how the other Jews would feel about this guy. It's more like, let's say Russia or some other superpower conquered the United States. And suddenly their guards are everywhere. They're in your neighborhood. They're telling you how many people you're allowed to have at your house, how you're allowed to worship. If they killed you, they'd probably get away with it. That's kind of what Rome was like. And then when it comes time to collect taxes, instead of hiring their own people to collect taxes from you, they actually called out your neighbor. You know the one that plays really loud music late at night and his dog poops in your yard and he doesn't return your tools? That guy? Now he is in charge of collecting your taxes. And they're not going to pay him a salary. Instead, they just empower him to collect extra from you and your neighbors. Now, you can't be totally sure that he's not just paying himself a living wage, but you do notice the new Porsche in his driveway, and he's remodeling his kitchen. How would you feel toward that dude, right? That's probably a little closer to how the other Jews felt about the tax collector. Now, Jesus, in this case, he doesn't tell us what kind of man this guy is. We don't know. I mean, what does it take to make you sign up to work for the enemy? Maybe his whole family died. Maybe he lost his land, and this is the only way for him to make ends meet. And maybe he does just collect a living wage. Maybe he's an honest guy. Or maybe he's always been kind of an unsavory, power-hungry kind of dude. And now Rome has empowered him to just express that. We don't know. But what we do know is he is so desperate at this point to get back into the grace of God, into the embrace of God, that he is willing to attend atonement service with his neighbors cheek by jowl, the neighbors that hate him. So how does this guy pray? The tax collector, standing far off, would not even lift up his eyes to heaven, but beat his breast, saying, God, be merciful to me, a sinner. Notice he's also standing away from the crowd, but he's not right there. He's way off. Whatever he is praying is between him and God. And his posture is eyes down. It's a posture of shame. He's beating his chest. Now, Bailey tells us that the custom of beating your breast, it was something that mostly women did when they were grieving. For men to beat their breast, it usually needs to be like a national crisis. We see this happening when Jesus died, for example. So this guy, it's like he's praying, and he includes a confession, I'm a sinner, and he also includes a plea for help, God be merciful to me. But the word he uses for mercy is not the normal word. It's the Greek word halaskamai, which actually means, it should be translated closer to, God make an atonement for me. This guy is praying with anguished intensity. God, even though my sin and shame is so heavy and so obvious, even though I have nothing to bring to you but my brokenness, God, let the embrace that you offered through this service, let it extend to me. This guy is approaching God through a lens of profound shame and utter humility. Hold on to that lens as well. So what does Jesus say about each of these guys and their lenses? He says, I tell you, this tax collector went down to his house justified rather than the other. Justified. We use that word to describe our margins, right? So when you think justified, think brought in line. Jesus is saying the tax collector got brought in right line with God, and the Pharisee didn't. So it's like Jesus is saying to the Pharisee, hey, you have indeed climbed very high on the ladder of following the law of God to earn his favor. But my friend, your ladder was leaning against the wrong building. You missed the boat. That is not the way to be at one with God. Your arms, if they're filled with all your accomplishments, they're not free to receive God's embrace. Tim Keller says, if you want to be a Christian, all you need is nothing. but most people don't have it. We approach God with our resumes, our recommendation letters, our morality, our money. The only way to receive God's gift is with open, empty arms. Okay, hold on. Theological time out here. Does that mean we don't have to do any good works? Does that mean all we need to do is kind of check the box that we believe that God atoned for us through what Jesus did in his death and resurrection, and that's all? Let's be clear here. Just as Dallas Willard says, God is not opposed to effort. He's opposed to earning. So if our good works are in response to what God has done for us, feel free to go crazy with good works, right? Feel free to fill your life with them and become more and more like Christ. That's awesome. When we get in hot water is when we think that our good works are earning God's atonement for us, right? That's when we go to the Bible study or our quiet time or the mission trip and we come back not justified, not at one with God. So what is Jesus saying to this tax collector? He says, you're approaching me empty-handed. You got no good works to show, but your humble, empty-handed posture is the right way to approach God. So that embrace that you longed for with your whole being, that you wanted from God, you got it. Humility is the way to approach God, period. Like the Mandalorian says, this is the way, right? Okay. But let's say the tax collector heard Jesus say this, and let's say he actually rejoiced in the temple, felt pretty good, and then on the way home, he's still watching his neighbors avoid him and insult him. And he's like, oh man, I have been so bad. The things that I've done, oh my gosh, they are so bad. You know, God said I'm forgiven, but I just don't feel it. Or maybe God forgives me, but I just can't forgive myself. Now, Jesus did not include that in the parable, but I want us to think about it for a moment because how many of us have felt that way? Maybe like Cindy from a few minutes ago. Maybe we've read that God forgives us. Maybe other people have told us we're forgiven, but we just have a hard time believing it. God might forgive us, but we're having a hard time forgiving us. For those of us who approach God through a lens of shame, the danger is that we will let our shame seem bigger than our God. C.S. Lewis writes, "If God forgives us, we need to forgive ourselves, because otherwise, it's almost like setting ourselves up as a higher tribunal, a higher court than God. It's like saying, well, God is the district court, and the district court said I'm forgiven, but I am the Supreme Court, and I say I'm not, right? The irony here is that the lens of earning and the lens of shame, they are actually two sides of the same coin. Both of them are focused on our performance, whether we're hitting it out of the park or we're lower than pond scum. Neither of them are focused on God and the fact that he is bigger than our performance or our failure. Humility and shame are not the same thing. Humility is having a right view of ourselves before God, that we are sinners in need of mercy, and we are also his beloved kids made in his image, both at the same time. Anytime our focus falls off of God and onto our performance or our failure, our hands are no longer open to receive his embrace. Just like the Germans say, you can fall off both sides of the horse. So I think that's what Jesus was getting at when he said, for everyone who exalts himself will be humbled, but the one who humbles himself will be exalted. Now, those of us who have come from contexts where that kind of paint God as this guy who's like out to get us if we make a mistake, we might be tempted to read that passage through that lens as like, don't think you're better than you are or God will bring you down. But if you're humble, he'll treat you well. I don't actually think that's the only thing that's going on here. This isn't the only place in the Bible where we see high things being brought low and low things being raised up. For example, when the prophet Isaiah is saying that Jesus, the Messiah, is going to come and bring peace and justice to the world, this is what he writes. A voice cries in the wilderness, prepare the way of the Lord, make straight in the desert a highway for our God. Every valley will be raised up, every mountain and hill be made low. The uneven ground shall be level, and the rough places a plain. Why? So the glory of the Lord shall be revealed, and then all flesh, all of us, will be able to see it together. The mouth of the Lord has spoken. The reason high things need to be brought down and low things need to be brought up is to make the way for God to work in the world, to bring justice and beauty and joy and goodness to us, but also to everybody. It's not just about our personal goals or our personal punishment. It's for the whole world. So if we want to be able to partner with God in bringing that beauty to the world, we need to start learning, hey, what are the lenses that we're seeing through that are off? How do we join him in adjusting them so that he can welcome us into his embrace? All right, so how do we know if we're approaching with an earning lens? These are just a few things that you might notice if you fall into the earning lens. Maybe not all of them apply, but pay attention to the ones that do. As we read the Bible or hear sermons, we feel like we've got it down, at least better than most people do. We often think of others who should hear this sermon or read this passage. When we encounter significant problems, maybe we think we got it together. We don't actually have to check in with God. We got it. When we're asked to serve, we probably feel pretty qualified. They're going to be lucky to have us. Secretly, we might feel special, like we have a deal with God that the bad things that happen to other people, they probably won't happen to us. But let's say the bad things do happen. We might respond by feeling mad that God is not upholding his end of the deal. It's not us that failed, it's him. When we compare ourselves to any of those groups, we might feel like we know better than the other group. We might feel exhausted from all of the good works and service we're doing for God. And it may be hard to remember the last time we really didn't have it together and God had to come and rescue us. Now again, not all those apply, but pay attention to those that do. Now how do you know if you might be coming from the shame lens? Maybe when you read the Bible or hear sermons, you might hear the ways that you don't measure up. Told that God is love, but it often feels like he's angry or disappointed with us. We don't have any problem believing God could love or forgive other people, but it feels hard to believe that he could love or forgive us. We might feel stuck or cursed, like if we hear about a bad thing happening, it's probably going to happen to us too. When we encounter significant problems, it feels like God probably won't help us. Maybe we can't help ourselves. His rescue feels like it's for other people and not for us. When we're asked to serve, we might turn it down because we don't feel qualified. If other people tell us we are qualified, we might still feel like an imposter. Like if they find out who we really are, they're going to reject us. Letting other Christians know who we are feels scary because, gosh, what if they don't like what they see and they criticize us or abandon us? Do either of those lenses sound familiar to you? Or maybe both of them do. Remember Helen and Cindy from a few minutes ago? Those are not two different women. Those are both me, just a few years apart. I will confess to you, I have felt every single thing on both of those earning lenses in my lifetime. Maybe you have too. We tend to fall in different ones at different times because they're two sides of the same coin. They're both focused on what we can bring and not who God is. So whether we find ourselves falling into earning or shame, what are some things that we can do to adjust our lens and get back into the embrace of God? And feel free to take pictures of the screen if that's helpful. If you're coming from an earning lens, one of the things you can do is read the Sermon on the Mount a lot. That sucker's impossible, right? Nobody's hitting that outside of the park, right? If we dwell on that for a season, it helps us notice the ways that we're falling short, that we need God to rescue us. When we encounter a significant problem, discipline ourselves to ask God, what should we do? To ask other people, right? It's not just us. We need to hear from God. When we're asked to serve, ask God, is this area of service something that will grow humility in me? And if not, trust God might have that position for somebody else right now. When bad things happen and you feel mad that God is not upholding his end of the bargain, practice the prayer, not my will but yours. I submit to you. I trust you more than myself. And meditate on that until you start to believe it. When you hear about another group, by all means, pray that God would bring them in alignment with his will so that they could be part of his embrace, but also pray that God could use people from that group to help you align with his will so that you don't miss out on his embrace. When you get exhausted from activities, take a rest, step back. This is God's work. He doesn't actually need you. It's okay to rest. And perhaps begin keeping a list of times that you've fallen short and God has come to your rescue. And go back and read over those and add to those as you go through life so that you know God has your back. It's not all about your earning. How do you adjust your lens if you're coming from a perspective of shame? Maybe for a long season, focus only on the parts of the Bible and sermons where God feels like really good news. Rescue, assurance, love, and mercy. And if you need a list of those, I have one. You can come find me after. When you come across a command or a punishment or a rebuke, tell yourself, this is not for me right now during this season. God needs to adjust my shame lens before I can hear his commands clearly. When you feel that who you are is so bad, there's no way that God's forgiveness and love can apply to you, make a choice to trust in the Lord your God and lean not on your own understanding, to trust that he forgives you even though you feel shame. When you encounter significant problems and fear that God won't help, pray through the Psalms. Highlight all the times that the psalmists were freaked out and then God ended up rescuing them or giving them a new perspective to cultivate your belief that he can do that for you too. When you feel like an imposter, meditate on my grace is sufficient for you, for my power is made perfect in your weakness. Turn your focus on God's power to equip you in your task rather than your own ability. And gradually take risks in having mature Christians get to know you more. Whenever you respond in vulnerability and they respond to that with love and kindness, make a note of it. Review that so that gradually you can come to believe that you can be both known and loved. Friends, as we go through life, of course we're going to fall into both earning and shame in different seasons. Christian maturity is not about arriving at a place and then just having static perfection from there on out. It's just not how human beings work. It's more about coming to know the lens that you have put on in that season and then understanding how to adjust it And that is the way that we can spend as much time in God's embrace as possible, just enjoying his love for us and working with him in the world. Let me pray for us. God, you know where each of these people in this room is coming from, and you love them right where they're at. Thank you for your invitations to us to come back into your embrace. Let us hear your adjustments so that we can know more of your love. In your name, amen.